The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Hey everyone, and welcome to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. I'm at one of the different fine wine, this is more of one of the more boutique wine storage places. It's the sneaky, quiet one around King, maybe Spadina, maybe Bathurst. I don't want to give the address away, but I am joined by Master of Wine and the Director of Education for CAPS Ontario. It is Elsa McDonald. Elsa, thank you so much for being on the podcast today.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Totally off topic. I feel that the city, what it needs to do with all the different private wine clubs, wine locker spaces all throughout the GTA, they all need to come up with very different sounding names, because I went to a different one. It wasn't that bad of a mistake. It only cost us about 8-9 minutes, though I hate making people wait. I feel they all need to just come up with very different names depending on however long they were there for. The oldest one gets the pick, and everyone else has to go somewhere in a completely different direction.
It's tough, and it's tough too when some of them are expanding, so they have two different locations. So this one is the Fine Wine Reserve, and they're here, but they're also out in Etobicoke. And then you have Vintage Conservatory, which to me actually sounds quite different, but it's just down the street here on King Street and also in Yorkville, so that compounds the confusion.
And you are right. They seem like they sound very different, and you are correct, but when you have horrible sense of direction and you get confused, I need the Grand Budapest Xylophone Wine Company Storage for Good Times Company. So something like that would help me.
Yeah, you don't have to go all the way to Budapest to get good wine storage, though.
You don't, but we did go to Crete. Let's start here. You brought a very delicious, the definition of what acidic Assyrtiko is supposed to be, a great kicking the ass on the palate earlier in the day wine. What did you bring for us to sip on for the interview?
I had a friend stay at my house while I was away, and this was left for me in the fridge as a gift. She said, I know you love Assyrtiko. I thought you might like this one. So it's actually from Crete. So it's an island in Greece that I've never been to. And I thought it was kind of fun to bring you something that I knew was going to be, as you say, bright in acidity, very juicy, lots of, you know, citrus aromas. It just feels like a breakfast wine in some ways.
Yeah.
It's a good way to start the day. So.
No, I love it. Yeah, different than if you brought, you know, a Valley Floor Napa Cabernet or an Amarone to start the day.
So what is just starting a different kind of day.
It kind of ends the day. If your day starts with Amarone, there's a morning nap coming.
I don't know.
So what is it that you love so much about Assyrtiko?
I've been to Greece a few times. When I did my first backpacking trip in my very early 20s, Greece was the first place that we landed. So it has a bit of a special place in my heart. And at that time, I didn't really know much about wine. I certainly didn't know that there was such interesting wine coming from Greece. And I've learned about that over the years. Assyrtiko has just always been one of my favorites. Part maybe because it originally comes from Santorini, which is the island that we actually went to visit on that inaugural trip.
But it's funny how that's true. Sometimes your favorite wines, it isn't always about what is the acid, sugar, tannin profile. A lot of times it is emotion. It is where you first went to. Sometimes it's family. I have family in northern Italy, and so fell in love with Barolo. Is Barolo a kick-ass wine? It is. Well, there's lots of great wines all over Italy, but I think part of it was history and family, and I think that
100%.
Kind of ties into it all.
100%. Later on that same trip, we went through Italy, and we actually were in Verona. And so we took a local bus out, and we visited a winery in Valpolicella. And for the next 2 years while I was living in London, whenever I would go to friends' houses, because you could get a liter and a half of Valpolicella for, I don't remember how much it was, but a very reasonable price because I didn't have any money. I would always bring them thinking I had, you know, a story because I'd been to the place. So other friends remember the wines I brought differently than I do, but... And they've teased me about it, but it's still a fantastic memory.
Yeah, it is. And that's always going to stay with you. So memories, we'll get to the past, but let's start with the present before we get more into your wine journey and becoming a master of wine. Just your current role with CAPS Ontario.
So CAPS is short for the Canadian Association of Professional Sommeliers.
Thank you for doing that.
And it's a membership organization with sommeliers across Ontario, so we're the Ontario chapter, but it is also part of a national organization. So many of the provinces also have the same organizations, and they do a little bit different in each province, but some of the main things that we do are the competitions. So there's regional competitions and also a national competition, and then that feeds into the global competitions. So CAPS Canada is part of ASI, which is the Association Sommellerie Internationale. So it's a global sommelier association, so that people who do our competitions actually can get to the Worlds or get to the All Americas. So competitions is a big part of it. But also, sommeliers in the city have a place where they can network and where they can meet other sommeliers and talk about their professional concerns. And education is a part of that. And so some people who are already certified SOMs, it's more about ongoing development and networking. And we also offer a full-time program. So you can come to school basically a day a week for a year, and you can become a sommelier educated in all the different regions of the world, also in service, also in theory. And we are actually launching a new program starting in September. So we're very excited to have, we're going to be hosting it at a new location. It's at the Vintage Conservatory, so not where we are today, but one of the other ones on King Street. They have partnered with us to allow us to offer these courses. So we're really excited about that being available. And I was actually in that course back in 2005. So it's kind of come full circle for me to be, you know, helping them organize it. So that's what CAPS is.
How important is CAPS for just the Ontario wine scene in general? And obviously, it's huge for the sommeliers. As you said, networking, also maybe a little bit of training or keeping up to date with what's going on. It's massive for people in that part of the industry, but for just wine overall in Canada.
I think when you are working in hospitality, it can be quite overwhelming in terms of your hours and the reality of what you're dealing with every day in terms of the intensity of the experience. And so it's very easy to become a little bit isolated and just be, you know, the only people you see in your waking hours are the people that you're working with, and maybe your family if you're lucky. So having an association where there are other people who understand your hours, understand that craziness and why you do it because you just love it, I think there's a lot to be said for that. I also think the international element of it is something that as an individual is very difficult, basically impossible to access. And so having the competitions, being connected with international standards and what's happening in terms of trends in other places, I think is quite valuable. So I think it can be tough for an individual sommelier to decide, do I want to be a member or not, because you are so busy. But I think that most people who do join find it to be quite rewarding if they just make that little bit of effort to get involved.
And then CAPS also can help out with the hardcore just wine enthusiast who wants to take their education to the next level, where they know that Burgundy means Pinot Noir or Chardonnay, but maybe they just want to know more about what makes Côte de Nuit so different from Côte de Beaune.
Yeah, exactly. And I think there's so many people who are interested in wine at a very deep level as a passion on the side of whatever career or life it is that they have. And this is a way for them to explore it in a way that it's kind of laid out for them. And there are other wine courses that you can take, but a lot of them tend to be more focused on independent study, which is fine, but you can do that sometimes without the course. So I think this really meets people where they're at.
How much fun are those wine competitions? I'm a geek. I love going to them. I will watch old wine competitions on YouTube, often to the chagrin of my girlfriend. And the worst part is I've rewatched old ones. I'm like, no. Watch what she's going to do here. She's going to, like, it's sad. But why? What is it that people should know about these wine competitions?
That absolutely does not make you sad. it does make you a nerd.
Yes.
What I find is that it's kind of agony in this when you're watching. If you know the people, it's even more agonizing.
Oh, you're seeing someone you know and you love, and they're going in a bit of a wrong direction. Or
they get asked a thing, and you know it's the thing that they studied, and you're like, yes, nail this. And then you see them pausing because you can see their mind has gone blank, and then suddenly the answer comes out. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, it's always notoriously difficult to do blind tasting, and do blind tasting with an audience is even more pressure. And to see people go the right way or the wrong way, it can also be interesting if you don't know what the wine is and you're listening to what they're reading, and then you start to think to yourself, okay, if I tasted that or smelled that, what would I conclude that wine is? And then to see what it actually is and if you're right. So I think it's really interesting to see people being so open about their reactions to what's in the glass.
It's also fascinating when people that you know are master sommelier, master of wine, or people that maybe don't have that accreditation, but they've been working in wine their entire life, and they get it just really wrong. Where even if a lot of their process is right, you know, they call it from a completely different country. I always find that fascinating as well, because it just goes back to one of the general themes, that wine is very humbling.
Notoriously, continuously. And it doesn't matter how much you know, you always know there's more to know, and you never know it all. And in a way, that's almost a liberating way to think about it, because then you can just go in and enjoy and don't expect yourself to know everything.
Yeah,
the more I've studied, the more that has rung true again and again and again.
Well, it's like what we're drinking here. You could go in a lot of different directions before calling this a Certico from Crete. It's you know, just one of the difficult things. But it's a good point by you, is that there is something freeing of knowing that no matter how much you've studied, by the time you finish listening to this interview, Italy has just come up with another grape varietal that no one had heard of 6 months earlier.
It's probably not that they've just come up with it. It's probably that they've started sharing it.
Right. Yeah. I'm convinced, or they just do it just to annoy North American people in wine, going, another grape I have to learn. I'm trying to keep up.
I find that's more about the regulations changing and what are the names of the sub-districts and the regions, and you know, who has formalized themselves as a region. And many countries are guilty of doing that. So
it is one of the hardest things about taking the course at CAPS or just wanting to become a SOM is you have to learn all the law stuff. And my God, I got my WSET diploma in 2015. Mm-hmm. It would be scary just to learn all the wine laws that have changed or all the new geographical indicators that have changed over the last 11 years.
Some of them, yes. Some of them, no. A lot of the classical regions in, let's say, you know, Burgundy, for example, you were talking about Neuilly-Saint-Georges earlier and Meursault. Those haven't changed.
Oh, no. God bless. Burgundy's never going to change.
Well, there's new ones that are becoming more relevant, right?
Right.
With climate change, the Haute Côte and, you know, further north. I'm trying to think of the name of the region I visited earlier this year, and it is Auxerre. Was the town that we stayed in, and so the Auxerrois wines, new to me, not new, but new to me, and now they're promoting them a little bit more because the price of Burgundy's gone up so much that these more modest wines that are getting more ripeness because of the temperature are coming to the forefront. So
yeah, that are Côte Chalonnais. Actually, Côte Chalonnais is crazy expensive now. You can't even really say, oh no, here's a Mercury, you're going to love it. It's like, no, it's still going to be $140 a bottle.
Yeah.
So how hard is this important piece of advice? When I was just doing a little research and finding past interviews for you, going back to wine, blind wine tasting, the answer is always in the glass. Listen to what the wine is saying to you and stop trying to make it into something that you think it is just because you got a whiff of something. Or don't game the wine when you're doing a blind wine tasting or you're studying or you're doing this on an exam. I've been guilty of it. I think a lot of people listening have been guilty of it. How hard is it to fully just adhere to that advice?
It's very, very difficult. And in fact, when I was writing my exams, I would, you know, if I didn't know what a wine was and it was, you know, a red full-bodied and I couldn't place it somewhere, I kept on making it Australian Merlot. Do you know how little Australian Merlot is actually produced? But it was because I didn't know where else to put it. So I knew it was kind of warm climate, new world, and I knew it was maybe a Bordeaux variety, but... and so once I figured out that I wasn't saying what I found in the glass, I was saying that I couldn't find it, then I realized I, you know, had some gaps. You can panic a little bit and you can lose your process, which is paying attention to what's in the glass, making your observations, and then looking at what you wrote down or what's at the front of your mind in terms of your observations, and not trying to change what you've actually observed because you've decided it's, let's say, you've decided it's a Chablis because you got a little bit of creaminess. There's a lot of white wines that have high acidity and a bit of creaminess that wine could be. when I was studying, I was constantly looking for these odd things, and I brought up the Australian Merlot because that would be what I started to call zebras. I'm in a room full of horses, and I'm looking for a zebra. And I always wanted to make the wines a little more obscure than they probably actually were, when
right.
it could easily be something very obvious. And so I used to have a little thing I would say to myself, you know, banish the zebras.
That's good advice.
And so stop looking for the zebras in the room full of horses.
I'm also trying to remember the last time I had an Australian 100% Merlot. I can't even remember. I can't even remember when I did that. You're right about, like, for anyone listening, that is the most important advice. I'll never forget my final exam, the tasting, and I smelt the first white. And it was like four, it was, I think, four wines from one region, or from one region. And I'm like, oh, this is Spain. And then when I went on to the third wine, I'm like, you asshole, you're in Loire. It's so obvious. And so I had to go back to the first wine and retaste it and remake my notes. And just, and I did pass, but I had that moment, like, I tried to game the system, even at the diploma level, for a moment. I think I just had a moment of panic.
And it's so easy, because once you believe that it's Spain in your example, then you feel confident and you just start writing. But you have shut off from what's in the glass. And if you're right, sure, you might get lots of points. But if you're wrong, and often you will be, and that's a pretty major difference, wines from, and Spain is a whole country, and Loire is a specific region.
Yeah.
But it's a country that tends to be quite warm. Versus, anyway.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, it's like, what are you going to do? You're going to try to find a way to ram Tempranillo into it. This is clearly a Cab Franc. So let's go back to you for a second here. You had a very different life, 2003-ish. Maybe the trips to Europe was part of the building blocks. I'm wondering how you started your journey into wine.
In 2003, I was working as a management consultant in telecom and financial services. So I did have a very different life. Even then, I was interested in wine because I had a thing called an expense account. So I could take the team out for dinners once a month on our projects. And I really enjoyed ordering the wine for the dinners. And when I decided to leave consulting, because I just felt like I was working. When you work that hard and you don't love the work or find a meaningful purpose in it, you can get a little bit bitter about the work. And then that can, you, if you do that for too long, you can become a bitter person. And I just didn't want that. So I thought to myself, what do I really enjoy? And part of it was those wine dinners. And I thought, I could be having a midlife crisis. I'm going to go to France for 3 months and just chill out, have some wine experiences, and see if there's somehow that I could make a career out of this. So all I knew was I was going to go somewhere famous for red and somewhere famous for white. So I went to Bordeaux for 6 weeks and Loire for 6 weeks, so 3 months in France. And then I registered at a language school, the thing you're supposed to do when you're 17. So I went to language lessons in the morning.
How old were you, by the way, for this approximately?
33,
yeah.
So I was going to, yeah, which is, you're supposed to do this when you're much younger. And the schools literally posted me with local families, which is what I wanted, that immersive experience. And not just for the language, but also, of course, for the wine and the food and so on. And then every afternoon, evening, weekend, I went to every chateau I could get into. And because I was in Bordeaux in September for an extended period, they have a local wine school for the CIVB, which is the interprofessional organization. Every Tuesday night, I would sit listening to lectures on the different regions of Bordeaux. And I was listening in French and tasting and writing all my notes in English because my French wasn't good enough yet. But I just thought that I had, you know, gone to heaven. And I, not surprisingly, after those 3 months, I came home and all I wanted to do was work in the business. So then it was a matter of finding a job. And my tendency is towards wanting to know what I'm talking about. So I just started doing the WSET level two, the level three, and so on.
Diploma, and then eventually the master.
Well, before I did diploma, I actually did the CAPS sommelier course.
Okay, yeah.
Because I didn't feel quite ready for diploma yet. I'd gone through level two and level three relatively quickly. I knew there was more depth in the course that I didn't quite have, so I thought I'd be in big trouble when I got to diploma, which is a lot of independent study. So I went to CAPS because then I knew I would go through it a little more thoroughly.
Right.
What I didn't know was how lucky I was going to be with all of the instructors that I had. This was the first formal cohort they had back in 2005. And, you know, I had David Lawrison, I had John Sabo, I had Linda Bramble, like really
Those are some pretty heavy hitters in the wine world. Yeah.
Yeah. I was very, very lucky. And many people who were in that course with me, we all feel the same way about the experience that we got at that time. So.
And it is a big jump from the WSET Advanced to the WSET Diploma. It's a massive one.
Mm-hmm.
But I want to go back to just, that must have been such a great time when you were in Bordeaux. Especially then, Bordeaux was smaller than it is now. And I'm not lamenting the growth of a city. Every city on planet Earth gets bigger.
Yeah.
That's the reality. But being able to spend all of that time there must have been just wonderful. What was the reaction of family and friends? Like you, technically, you've got this very successful job. You obviously successful and good enough in it where you're in charge of the expense account.
Yeah.
To do such a 180, what was the reaction for the people closest to you?
I thought people were going to think I was nuts. But actually what people said was, you've kind of made some big changes before. When I was 24, I moved to 24, so I'd only been working for 3 years. I moved to the UK thinking I just want an international experience. And I ended up getting a really good job with a company car. I mean, who has that at that age? And people were surprised when I did that. So by the time, 10 years later, people had said, you've done these sorts of things before. You'll do something with it. And they were just excited to see what I would do. So, then there was suddenly responsibility on me to do something cool. But yeah. that was very encouraging, actually. And yeah. The people that I worked with, they probably thought I was crazy. And I don't think I really understood what I was giving up in terms of income, for sure. And lifestyle, that kind of core feeling that I was doing something that felt meaningful to me was super important to me. That sort of trumped everything else. So,
quality of life over quality of bank account.
Well, quality of bank account can really bring you a lot of quality of life. That is for sure.
That is true.
I'm not denying that.
Yeah.
And what I'm saying is that when I first went into it, I thought I could have both. I didn't realize kind of the choice I was making. But how much is enough?
Yeah.
I could definitely get enough and be quite comfortable. So.
Yeah, and you wake up with more joy about what your day is going to be versus, as you said before, just you don't want to go down the path of waking up and being bitter. What were the hardest moments for Master of Wine, which I believe you got in 2018,
mm-hmm.
still, I believe, less than 400 on planet Earth, which is a cool distinction. I always love asking people whether it's Master of Wine. Actually, let's start here. What's the difference when someone hears Master of Wine versus Master Somm, those two very different paths?
So the Master Sommelier was really designed as a role that would be held in the hospitality world. That means that somebody who's a Master Sommelier typically is managing a cellar of some kind. They are managing a list. They are working directly with consumers, or they may be doing that for a group of restaurants, but they are acquiring the wines. They are managing it. They are deciding, what the focus is going to be. And they also have a broader program. They may also own all the other beverages, right? Coffee, tea, spirits, waters. They may also have a cigar program. They may even venture, not as commonly into cheese, but definitely into the food pairings that match with that, and they're working with a specific clientele. Now, lots of master sommeliers have taken the skills that they got to become a master sommelier, and they're doing all kinds of different things. They are consulting with specific producers. They are consulting with specific restaurants. So where they take their career could be quite different, but that's kind of the basis of what they're learning. So you have to learn the theory, you have to learn the service, you have to learn sommelier management. And then where the crossover comes is in being knowledgeable about the wines of the world. They do have tasting exams, but they're very focused on knowing the classics and fine wine. The Master of Wine is a little bit broader, and people are often from much different careers. But again, there's the base of what a Master of Wine needs to know and then what you decide to do with it. The Master of Wine has 5 theory papers and 3 tasting papers. And then you have a research paper after all of that. So your 5 theory papers are viticulture, winemaking, managing wine, so like bulk and cellaring, sending things around the world. Then you have a marketing paper, and you also have current trends. So it's a little bit broader in terms of the business context, which makes sense because you have people who are doing Master of Wine who, yes, you have journalists in both, but somebody who's doing it from more of a wine perspective, or you have people who are buyers for grocery stores or those sorts of things. You also have people who are winemakers, who are educators, lots of different roles. Then you also have three tasting papers. So on our exams, you have to taste 36 wines. First paper is white, 12 wines. You taste blind and you answer questions about them. And each question is worth 25 marks. The second one is reds. And the third one is everything else. So sparkling, fortified, rosé, and you could get some more red and white, maybe some vintage questions in there. So it's a lot broader in terms of what we're actually tested on blind, but also the selection of the wines themselves. It could be, you know, a $10 rosé. It could be a $500 Bordeaux Grand Cru Classe.
And let's go on the tasting side. What do you remember from those 36 wines?
Oh,
like was there one that really,
from my actual exam?
Yeah, was there? Do you remember it? Was there one that really confused you? Was there one that threw you? Was there one that you patted yourself on the back that you got right? I only bring this up. I remember I nailed the Spe Burgunder, and that was
good job.
Thank you. That was over 10 years ago, and I still bring that up.
Yeah,
it's so sad.
One of my biggest fears was always neutral whites, meaning white wines that aren't necessarily aromatic. They tend to be high in acidity. They might have minerality. They might not. They don't have very specific fruit character. They're all about texture. So figuring out where those come from, they make them in France, Italy, Spain, lots of places in the New World. You can have volcanic versions. You know, there's all sorts of different. So that was always my nemesis, if you get kind of three neutral whites, especially because when you first sit down, often the wines are a little bit cool, so they're showing even less of what they might be. But even worse is if you get a neutral all Italian flight.
Oh, that's horrible. That's mean.
On my exam, I got it.
But oh, no.
I was so afraid of it for so long that I had done a lot of studying, and I knew that I might not be able to identify these wines, but I can say a heck of a lot about them. I am going to nail what their style is, what their price, what their commercial positioning is, and really what is the what they want you to understand is the quality within the wines that you're tasting. So one of them was Roero Arnis, and the other one was an Oaked Suave. And I managed to pass that year.
Congrats.
Yeah.
That
was pretty tough. Yeah.
I don't want to swear. What a bunch of assholes. the importance, and you kind of touched on it, but on that journey to getting that degree, the importance of mentors, and also how lonely can that prep be?
So I was in the program for 7 years. I actually applied in 2011 and did not get in. So I applied again the next, 2010 it must have been. But I did get in the next year once I kind of sorted myself out and got a few mentors who I actually told them what I had applied with, and they would look at me and I swear they wanted to pet me on the head and say, oh, how naive, you know, how sweet that you thought that would get you in. Anyway, so I pulled my socks up and managed to get in 2011. So it took me 7 years to finish it. And at the beginning, I was just so excited to be there. Sometimes I would sit down at one of the tastings and I couldn't focus for the first couple minutes, and every minute matters when you have so little time to write about the wines, because I was just so excited to be there. And over time, that excitement, I'm not going to say it wore off. What I realized was that was just a different form of anxiety, actually, that I was kind of paralyzed to start thinking about the wines. So I managed to get that under control. But I attempted the exam for the first time in 2015, and I got my theory on my second try, and then I got my tasting on my fourth try, and then I got my research paper on my first try. So, you know, we all have skills in different areas, and tasting was by far for me the biggest challenge and the biggest hurdle. And I remember wanting to give up when I just thought I couldn't do it. And it was my study buddy who kind of said, okay, this is the process that you have to do. Just put the two wines down beside each other that you keep on confusing, write down what they have in common, write down how they're different, and then taste yourself blind on those same two wines every day. And I got better at it somehow when I stopped thinking about the pressure and focusing on what was in the glass. So it was a long process, but it's really lovely being on the other side.
What did you open after you found out you passed? Do you remember what you opened? How did you celebrate?
Well, it was kind of funny. I there's a couple different times when you find out you passed. And the time that was very exciting for me was when I found out I passed tasting. That was different than when I found out I passed the entire exam. Because by the time I got there, I was pretty sure that, that my research paper was going to be accepted. And so I was very excited. And actually, believe it or not, I was visiting my father, and we went to the local LCBO because I didn't have any, I didn't have the wines on hand that I wanted. We weren't at home. We were at a cottage, and so we went to the local LCBO. And the best thing I could find was Perrier Jouet Rosé. It was 100% Pinot Noir, and it was a wine that I had tasted blind many times during studying. And I thought that would be very appropriate. It was different once I, you know, started to have parties, and then I could select wines very specifically. But that was the one for that moment. And I remember my father saying, "You just paid $100 for a bottle of wine." And I said, "Yeah, Dad, it's way less than I paid for most of the wine."
Yeah,
all
exactly.
The wine over these, you know, years to get here. And if I'd failed the wine again, it would have cost me way more than this. So
I bet that rosé tasted pretty good.
Oh, yes, it really did. It really did.
So as we end this, just again for people listening, why they should get involved with CAPS or check out the wine competitions or the people that are wine curious that just want to continue this path. Because also, by learning more about wine, it's going to lead to you traveling more. And you're going to end up in small villages and cool places in the world. And it's going to hurt your wallet. It'll probably hurt your waistline. But it will make your life better. So why should people investigate what you're doing with CAPS?
Oh, I thought you were going to ask a different question, so I want to give you that answer first.
Do the different one.
You know,
I work in sports media. I all the time answer a different question than the one I've been given.
I look at wine as a set of lenses to have on the world. You know, I've known people in my life who were sailors, who they look at the map of the world and it's all about the ports, whereas I always think of the main cities or wherever the main airports are. And I used to know somebody who had a small plane and they looked at the world by small airports that none of us even know exist. And I like to look at the world as where the vineyards are and what styles of wines are coming from where. And when you go to a place and you have something to talk to people about that's important to them, you get to know about their culture. And you're not, I mean, you're still a tourist, but you're not a tourist in the way that you are just consuming everything they have. You actually get to connect with people, and you find that you have so many things in common in terms of, it could be what are the pests and diseases that your vines are struggling with. It could be what food does this go with, or lots of people don't like aged white wine, but we know the truth and we are going to drink aged white wine together, or, you know, whatever it is. And so I think that connection is what wine can bring. And becoming a member of a sommelier association, you meet other people who have those same values. Many of us in the trade end up on trips together that are, you know, sometimes sponsored by local consortiums of wineries, whether it's regional or, you know, just a group that's come together. And you never forget those trips, and you never forget the people that you met on those trips. And it really, I think, brings the world together. And as you say, 100% just makes your life better.
That's a great answer. Better answer than my question. Elsa, I really appreciate this. And congrats on making that leap back in 2003 and just becoming a master of wine and the work you're doing now with CAPS, which is important. And anyone out there, go. What's the website? Where do people go? I mean, you can just Google CAPS and you'll find
it. Yeah, look for CAPS Ontario.
Yeah.
So capsontario.ca and
easy.
You'll find us.
Thank you so much for the acidic white from Crete. First time I've had an Assyrtiko from this little slice of the world. Cheers. Thank you so much for being on the pod.
Cheers.
Thanks, everyone, for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Remember, you can find me on Apple, Spotify, iTunes, and wherever quality podcasts are sold.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.